The analysis of a process requires the identification of specific parts and investigation of the related event, such as just the QRS. The QRS is related to the ventricles. You don't care about the P wave. If you are interested in the atria, you look at the P wave. So it is necessary to consider parts of the signals that we have seen so far. So the general problem statement here is, given a biological signal, identify discrete signal epochs or intervals and correlate them with events in the related physiological processes. By correlate, I don't mean the mathematical correlation, but draw links. The solution to this general problem statement is to develop signal processing techniques to emphasize certain parts of a signal, to detect certain parts or segment, and then analyze them. Emphasis here means you are modifying the signal so that the part of the signal related to what you are interested in is made bigger or somehow shown better. You may distort the waveform, but now you're not. But to analyze the signal, you would have to go back to the original signal at that time position. So emphasis is to identify the presence of something that is detected. Segmentation is applied to the original, and you cut the portion of the original signal related to that. And then you analyze those reports. So let's consider a few possible case studies. First, we'll look at the ECG, PQRST, we know that. In the book I have detailed description, I have removed a lot of the details because we have seen all of these before. The P wave is related to the contraction of the atria as triggered by the sinoatrial node impulse. The PQ segment we know is related to the delay introduced by the atrioventricular node to facilitate completion of atrial contraction and transfer of blood to the ventricle before the ventricle contraction is initiated. Normally, the PQ segment is flat or isoelectric. Then we have the QRS wave that relates to contraction of the ventricles when the Purkinje fibers stimulate contraction of the ventricles on both left and right simultaneously, normally. The ST segment is expected to be normally flat or isoelectric, again, related to the plateau in the action potential of the ventricular myocytes or muscle cells. Myocardial ischemia infarction could alter the ST segment by either elevating it or depressing it. And I have shown some examples of these. So you could call these epochs or events in the ECG. The ST segment is not an event, it is part of the contraction itself, but it is an important epoch or interval in the ECG to which a cardiologist will pay attention. Similarly, the PQ interval, there's nothing happening, but nothing should happen in that interval, normally. And that is expected, and one pays attention to these intervals also. Then we have the T wave that is related to the last phase of the action potential, where the action potential comes back to the resting phase of negative value, and that causes a change in the ECG, where you see the smooth P wave. So we need to recognize these activities that go on in the heart and how they relate to the ECG. So when you look at an ECG, you know this is what it is related to. In the heart sound that we have seen, this is what we have already seen, but I'll quickly go through this. The first heart sound, S1, reflects a sequence of events related to ventricular contraction, the closure of the atrioventricular valves between the atria and the ventricle. When the ventricles begin to contract, they push the valve leaflets and the valves close. And then there is isovolumic contraction. All the valves are shut, the ventricles build up pressure. And then the semilunar valves, the aortic and pulmonary valves open, and blood is sent out. Ejection of the blood from the ventricles, left ventricle to the aorta, right ventricle to the lungs. Related to the end of ventricular contraction. when the aortic valve and the pulmonary valve is closed, and that finishes systole and the injection of blood. So closure of the aortic and pulmonary valves, that is an important event, as indicated by the components A2 and P2 of S2. And in the dichrotic, and corresponding to the dichrotic notch in the carotid pulse. There could be murmurs, and these are additional events that are abnormal. Normally, the intervals are silent between S1 and S2, and S2 and the next S1. But there could be systolic murmur of aortic stenosis that is related to the turbulent ejection of blood from the left ventricle through a restricted aortic valve opening. As I said earlier, the aortic valve is supposed to open completely and let blood go out from the ventricles to the aorta. But if the aortic valve is stenosed, the valve will not open fully, but instead will form a narrow opening. And when blood is forced through a narrow hole, there will be turbulence. And that causes a certain specific pattern of systolic murmur. Diastolic murmur is caused in the case of several other problems. One of them is aortic insufficiency, when the aortic valve does not close properly. So when the ventricles are relaxing, on the other side of the aortic valve, there is a systemic pressure from the rest of the body. The blood is still at a high pressure on the other side. And the ventricles are relaxing and receiving blood from the atria, or in the case of the aortic valve, the left ventricle is relaxed and blood is coming from the left atrium through the mitral valve. At this time, there is pressure across the aortic valve. It is supposed to remain shut. But if it is insufficient due to some disease, it will have a small opening and blood will come back into the left ventricle. That is during ventricular diastole. And that is regurgitation of blood from the aorta back into the left ventricle through a leaky aortic valve that is not closing properly. These are just two situations. As I said earlier, there are four valves and two primary conditions of stenosis or insufficiency, so 4 × 2, 8 such conditions. Then we saw the carotid pulse, where there is the dichrotic notch. It's a little kink, but it provides important information about closure of the aortic valve, which causes a sudden drop in the aortic pressure on the downward slope, just after the ejection of blood has finished, and when the valve closes, there is a change, and that is indicated by this incisura, as it is called. The dichrotic notch in the carotid pulse is a delayed version because of the transmission from the roof of the aorta up to here, and that's of the order of a few milliseconds, 20 or so milliseconds. I'll show that later. All of these are important because later on I'll give you many examples and then you need to remember these. In the EEG, we saw that there are important rhythms, alpha, beta, theta, and delta, or the other way around there. And there could also be additional events. The alpha, beta, delta, and theta are simply bands of frequency from 0.5 to 13 for the theta, delta, theta, and alpha, and then beta is high. But in addition, there could be a few other discrete events and some epochs in the EEG, and I have not mentioned these earlier. I put these here because I just want to have these as events. I could have very well put this in the first chapter. But there are a few more waves that I'll explain now briefly. On EEG technology. These are a few important types of events that could occur in the EEG that are not the alpha, beta, delta, and theta rhythms. But this is called the K complex. Let me use this point. This is called the K complex. Looks like a pulse. I'll give the details later on. This is called a lambda wave. This is called the mu rhythm. This is a spike, a transient, and these are sharp waves that are not as sharp as the spike, but still sharp for the EEG. They look like the QRS complexes in the ECG. And here you have the spike and the wave train, which I showed earlier, but I showed on an expanded scale. In this time scale, which is 1 second for so much, it is clear that there is a sharp transient wave called a spike, like that. And then there is a wave, which in this case is half of a sinusoid. But sometimes it could be a full period of a sine or cosine. So spike and wave and spike and wave. Spike is sharp, the wave is slow. And that can appear in an almost periodic or quasi-periodic manner. And then this is called a sleep spindle. During sleep, there could be a pattern like this occurring in groups of 2, 3, 4 seconds each. And here, H is a vertex sharp wave. These are also sharp waves like those. And these are very high frequency polyspike discharges. Usually when there is something sharp and of high frequency beyond 13 14 hertz, as I mentioned earlier, these would be considered to be suspicious and could possibly be related to regions in the brain that could cause epileptic seizures or discharges. So the K-complex is a transient complex with slow waves, sometimes associated with sharp components, and often followed by 14 hertz waves. And it occurs spontaneously or in response to a sudden stimulus during sleep, about 200 microvolts. Lambda waves are monophasic, positive sharp waves. They occur in the occipital location with an amplitude less than 50 microvolts. They're related to eye movement and associated with visual exploration. The mu rhythm is a group of waves in the 7 to 11 hertz range, and they look like a comb pattern or arcade pattern in the central location. Some of these are specific to particular parts of the brain and will be observed best or will be observed in certain parts on the scalp, in certain regions on the scalp, using the 1020 electrode position that I mentioned earlier. So the central location is the C location in that system that I showed on the first day or the second day, I don't remember. The amplitude is of the order of 50 microvolts. It is attenuated by contralateral movement, thought of movement, readiness to move, or some stimulation. So analysis of this kind of a rhythm is not, not made from one observation or record, but is made during continuous observation or observation of the patient over a certain interval of time where certain activities are performed. So this is not a snapshot, but you have to observe over a certain period of time the response in relation to certain activities or the lack of activities. A spike is a transient with a pointed peak of a few milliseconds duration, 20 to 30 milliseconds. A sharp wave is a transient with a pointed peak and a little longer than a spike, 70 to 200 milliseconds. Spike and wave rhythm I mentioned earlier. Sleep spindle is about 14 hertz, 50 microvolts, and in the frontocentral regions, and that is related to certain stages of sleep. And in EEG analysis, sleep staging is an important application, where patients with sleep disorders are monitored overnight. The patient goes to the lab and sleeps overnight. The EEG is continuously recorded and monitored by a technologist. In Calgary, I invite practicing clinical specialists, doctors or technologists, or also entrepreneurs who develop instruments in the industry to come and give a lecture in my class at the end of the last day. Unfortunately, that is not possible in an intensive course like this. But we had a speaker from a sleep clinic come and talk about his experience in analyzing sleep patterns. By analyzing the EEG, they can stage, a technologist can stage the sleep as to light sleep and deep sleep and dreaming and any other disturbances, and then inform the patient of what is happening, what was observed, and possibly help the patient correct the situation and get better sleep. The idea is to help the patient sleep better, because if they are sleep deprived, then they will not be able to perform well in the following days. Or on a day-to-day basis, if a patient is sleep deprived, then the performance at work or anywhere else will be poor on a continuing basis. So sleep clinics exist for this purpose. Vertex sharp or transient or V wave is a sharp potential at the vertex about 300 microvolts and negative in relation to the EEG in other areas. I don't expect you to memorize these, but I just want you to recognize that such things exist in various signals. And this occurs spontaneously during sleep, all in response to sensory stimulus during sleep or wakefulness. The analysis of EEG is performed and described in terms of these following items. What is the most persistent rhythm? Is it alpha, beta, theta? What is the overall picture? Then, what are the other rhythmic features that are present in multiple and not in the others? And over time, if you're observing the patient over 2 hours, what happened? Was it alpha and then did it switch to beta? Or did the patient come in when you started, was it beta primarily, which means an excited or anxious state, and did it go down to alpha later? Discrete features of relatively long duration, such as an episode or spike in wave activity, did any of these happen? Discrete features of short duration, such as spikes and sharp waves. Activity remaining when all of the above have been described. What else is there in the EEG? And artifacts, or were there any problems in identifying these? Is there any ambiguity? So analysis of the EEG and description of an EEG record is fairly detailed in this manner. Each EEG wave of activity is described in chronological sequence versus time in terms of amplitude, frequency in the case of rhythmic features, waveform in the case of rhythmic and transient features, and location or spatial distribution, where on the scalp was this observed. Incidence or temporal variability, when did this happen and how often and how long. And right-left symmetry, with reference to the midline, is it on the left side or right side, and do you have similar activity for the same position on either side of the midline, or not. Symmetry is expected under normal conditions. And responsiveness to stimuli, such as eye opening, closing, and if something was applied, a stimulus was applied as part of the experiment, what was the response? The EEG record is at rest is first described. The patient is asked to relax, and then effects of evocative techniques specified in the same terms. So you apply a stimulus, light or sound, and then observe what happens. Behavioral changes, such as falling asleep, they're also noted. So the analysis of the EEG is performed in a different manner as compared to the other signals. So let's now look at methods to detect events. We'll start with the basic method to detect, or a few basic methods to address a very simple problem, and which is considered to be an important problem, of course, which is measuring the heart rate, identifying every heartbeat and measuring the heart rate. Now that by itself was an important and significant signal processing activity a few decades ago. Now it is simple, now it is well known and understood. But if you go back to the 1960s and 70s, when digital signal processing was just being developed and digital filters were just being developed, this was a main problem, a major issue, research issue. Now there are several instruments that can easily measure and display heart rate. So the technology has developed and matured to a significant extent over the past 20, 30 years. So let's consider the problem of developing signal processing techniques to facilitate the detection of the QRS complex, given that it is the sharpest wave in the ECG cycle. So we need to have that observation and that understanding. And that is because the QRS complex corresponds to the contraction of the ventricles. The ventricles have specialized conduction system with the propinquity fibers, and they squeeze rapidly, and in a matter of 80 milliseconds, you have two or three phases going up and down of the order of 1 millimole or more in total range. Whereas the P wave is smooth and soft and slow, and the T wave is smooth and soft and slow. So this is the sharpest part, which means a derivative-based technique should be useful. So the solution is based upon the use of derivatives. When you take the derivative, we saw earlier, we used the derivative to try to remove low-frequency artifact. And we saw that in addition to removing the low-frequency artifact, the P and T waves were also removed, and the QRS was destroyed. But we were left with a big pulse at the position, not pulse, but almost an impulse, at the position of the QRS. That was not useful for filtering, because the output waveform was not like an ECG anymore, but it could be used to detect the position of the QRS. There are several techniques that are based upon the application of the derivative for this purpose. The QRS has the largest slope or rate of change of voltage in a cardiac cycle. That we know from a study of the heart, the cardiovascular system, and ECG. There's rapid conduction and depolarization of the ventricles. So, use the rate of change. Wherever it is the largest in a cardiac cycle, that is the QRS. The rate of change is given by the derivative, d over dt, or z to the minus 1, or 1 minus z to the minus 1, in terms of the z transform. The derivative operator enhances the QRS, as we saw. The result does not bear any resemblance to the typical QRS. But now we are not interested in waveform analysis. We just want to know where is the QRS complex, or where are QRS complexes along the signal for every beat. The slow P and T waves are suppressed, but to measure heart rate, we don't need those. We just need one marker per cardiac cycle. We saw that the result of taking the derivative is very noisy. Noise is emphasized because the transfer function of the derivative operator has a gain that increases linearly with frequency. So high frequency noise is boosted significantly, and the result is very noisy. So you need to remove that noise and reduce the high frequency energy. Sometimes they use energy and power interchangeably. You know that power is simply the rate of energy. So they are equivalent in some sense. There's an algorithm proposed by Balda and others in the 1970s where the smooth three-point first derivative is used. I showed this expression earlier, where you average the basic first derivative over two samples. So you take xn minus 1, and then xn minus 1 minus xn minus 2, average them, and the result is xn minus 2. Now there is a scale factor, but you can ignore all of these. There is a 1 over 2t there. But they did not use that factor. You can build that into the threshold later, because all you will do is apply a threshold and say there's a beat here, and there's a beat there, and there's a beat there. So some of these factors could be removed. And in those days, in the 1960s and 70s, computation was rather slow. And several shortcuts were taken to remove and minimize computational steps, or any step that required unnecessary computation was removed. The second derivative was also used here and was approximated as y1 equal to xn minus 2, xn minus 2 plus xn minus 4. This is an estimate of the second derivative. And this is also smooth. And then they said they would combine the two derivatives. Y2 is the presence of a QRS complex in the output. So these are coefficients that are used so that an appropriate threshold can be applied. Assuming that the ECG has been calibrated properly and the amplifiers as in standard ECG are used, so it should be about 1 millivolt. Assuming all of that, then the threshold of 1 is applicable if these are combined using such weights. But these are for practical purpose. So whenever the threshold is crossed, the subsequent 8 samples will also test it for the same threshold. And if at least 6 of the 8 points pass the threshold test, a segment of 8 samples is taken to be a part of the QRS. This is because for the entire duration of the QRS complex, which is about 80 milliseconds, the rate of change is fast. There could be some spikes in the ECG and there could be some noise somewhere, and you don't want isolated spikes of noise to affect your decision. That's the ECG, and if you were to compute the derivative and so on, you expect a large value there. This is just schematic. And you expect this large value to be present for about 80 milliseconds. Now, there could be some noise. And there might be a noise spike there. And the output may give you a large value there. And you don't want this to be called a QRS. And you check how many samples are satisfying the requirement of the threshold. Let's say the threshold is here. If only one or two samples meet the condition, then you say it is not a QRS. You must satisfy for at least 8 samples. I suppose they use 100 hertz then as a sampling rate. It's not clear from the paper. There are some papers, some works earlier, including my own, where the sampling rate used for the detection of beats is only 100 hertz. For to preserve the morphology of the ECG, the recommended rate is at least 200 hertz, perhaps 500 hertz. But if all you want is the heart rate, a sampling rate of 100 hertz is enough. So each sample is 10 milliseconds. So, if at least 6 of 8 consecutive positions pass the test and have a value more than that threshold, then you call that a QRS. Fairly simple technique. And the result is a pulse width with a pulse with its width proportional to the QRS width that I showed there. So you could also measure the width of the QRS. And if it is longer than 800 or 80 milliseconds, then there is something wrong. Now, 80 is normal, up to 100 may be considered to be normal. If it is 120 milliseconds, you could consider the possibility of bundling branch block or hypertrophy. I'll show you the example here. So here is a signal with the 2 beats, and that is Y0. And this is Y1, based upon the second, Y0 is the first derivative, and Y1 is the second, and Y2 is the combination. Okay. So this is the first derivative, this is the second derivative, and this is the combination. And what is Y3? Let me see here. Okay, I put one more filter. When I applied their method to my ECG signal, I did not get a clear pulse. I smoothed it further and then got a pulse like this. So some extra smoothing was required, although there is no noise here. So this is the first derivative. The second, the combination as given by Baldanovas, but I got this. And to reduce it to an almost single pulse, I had to do this. Further smoothing. So you apply a threshold on this, and then you can detect the beats. Before applying the method, I filtered the noisy signal with a low-pass filter of 90 Hz, Butterworth low-pass filter, downsampled by a factor of 5, and notch filter of 60 Hz. That could be the reason why the method did not work for me, because their sampling rate might have been 100 hertz. So some of the parameters are set for specific conditions of the experiment and may not work in a different under different conditions. Professor Murthy was my PhD supervisor from 1976 to 1980. That's when I did my PhD. And this is my first name, and in India we typically write the first name and put the family name as initials, as in some other countries. That's what I used to do then. And this is an algorithm that we developed for the detection of QRS complexes in ECG and then perform other steps for the analysis of ECG. Here, we are taking the derivative, xn minus I plus 1 and xn minus I. So this, the difference between the two is one sample. So this is the first derivative, we square it, and then we apply a window, n minus I plus 1, which is a triangular window, a linear weight factor. So past samples are multiplied with lower weights. The current sample is given the highest weight. So it's a triangular smoothing window. And then we get this expression, or this quantity G1n. It is further smoothed by using a moving window filter, the moving average filter that I showed earlier. But for a sampling rate of 100 Hz, we use m and n equal to 8. There are two filters with windows m and m here, and we used 8 samples. So here we have the first derivative only. We are not using the second derivative. It's a fairly simple derivative with only two samples being used. And then there is a smoothing step performed here, convolving with a linear window, a triangular window, if you want to call it, just decaying linearly. And then there is a moving average filter here. So two steps of smoothing. And then to search peaks in this result, there is a simple peak searching algorithm. You scan a portion of the signal GN expected to contain a peak, determine the maximum. It may not be suitable for online except with a delay. If you want to do it online, there will be a small delay when you have to find an appropriate threshold. Define a threshold as half of that maximum. And then for all GN greater than threshold, select those samples for which the corresponding GN values are greater than a predefined number M of preceding and succeeding samples. So you check on both sides. And you want that number of samples to pass this test. It's not isolated types of noise. So then you form the set P. This is in an offline manner. You form the set of indices P containing all n such that gn is greater than threshold, and gn is greater than gn minus 1 for a certain number of samples with n minus I rather. For a certain number of samples m, and gn is greater than gn plus I on the other side. So you scan both sides, so you want to be in the middle. And if this condition is satisfied, then that is a QRS point. So here is an example, the same ECG signal that I showed earlier. This is from a noisy signal that is already pre-filtered. And this is the output G1, this is the output G. Now we have a fairly smooth pulse. It's not a square pulse, but it's been smoothed significantly. And note that the P and the T waves are fairly large and prominent in the signal, but the output has almost nothing for the P and T waves. That is expected. The derivative operator will suppress the slow P and T waves, and the derivative is large at the QRS. And when you square it, it is a nonlinear operation that will increase the values here and suppress the low values here. So the derivatives for the P and T are small, and by further smoothing, you can suppress those and enhance the output for the QRS complex. And the signal is already filtered to remove noise. And what I did was took two cycles. What I show here is just two cycles of the ECG in figure 3.5. And before doing this, I filtered with an 8-order Butterworth filter with a cutoff of 40 Hz, downsampled by a factor of 10, because that signal was sampled 1,000 Hz. So now the effective sampling rate is 100 Hz. And then normalize the signal, because the value is not, the amplitude is not important. So this is the pre-processing that I did to get this signal from a noisy ECG. And then applied the derivative base. So as I said, the whole idea is to reduce the QRS complex to a pulse and everything else to very low values of almost zero. What this value is not important. What you want to detect is the presence of a peak that has a minimum duration of at least 60, 70, 80 milliseconds. If there are spikes somewhere in between, there could be noise, due to noise, even after filtering, and you have to ignore those.
What is the delay if you detect the, from the G signal the B? How does it map to real ECG?
Yeah, from here
is
to there.
Is there a constant?
Yeah, these delays, that's a good point. I was coming to that later in the Pan-Tompkins algorithm. There will be delays between the starting point of the QRS and the peak that you detect. And they are introduced by the filters. And these filters have delays of n and n. The derivative introduces a delay of only one sample, but the smoothing filters, there are two filters of samples, of n samples and m samples, so that will be n plus n minus 1, or including the derivative will be n plus n. So if it is 8, then there will be a difference of 16 samples from the beginning of the QRS. Here. Approximately, because we don't know where exactly the peak will be. So you may not get exactly this point, but a few samples before or after, quite a few before. Unless you go for the upstroke of this peak and get a point here. You can put additional conditions so that you don't have to go to the peak, but to the end of the positive of the increasing slope. You don't want to be on that side. So you can have additional conditions there. And the delay must be subtracted. A popular algorithm that's well established is the Pan-Tompkins algorithm. And we'll be asking you to write MATLAB programs to do this and test with the data being provided. Imre has prepared 6 lab exercises. We have changed them from the previous lab exercises. If you want to, I have checked my website, by the way, and it is now open. There was some change made in Calgary, and for some reason they had blocked the folders within my website. I emailed my systems analyst, and now it is corrected. We have selected 6 lab exercises from the 10 that I normally give in Calgary, and we have simplified them. We have removed some extra steps that we thought were not required because you only have 1 month, whereas my students in Calgary have 3 months for this whole course. So there will be 6 lab exercises. I'll go through them and Imre will be putting them on the course website. There are 6 sets of assignments, problems from the ends of the chapters that are already posted, are they?
I don't post this.
Not yet. So today perhaps? Or?
Yeah, hopefully today.
Okay. So today, today Imre will post the problem set, but they're all from the ends of the chapters, and there are 6 sets from each one set from each chapter. Each set has 3-4 problems. Yeah, it's approximately each set will take you about 1 hour of work, and you have to write this by hand or by.
You just scan after doing some of the. Drawings and you just send in electronic format.
Yeah, you will be asked to draw some waveforms, and I don't think you can use any computer tool for that unless you have something that really allows freehand drawing. So I suggest you just draw by hand and scan it and send it. If you want the equation, there are some that require equations to be written. If you want, you can use Word or LaTeX, but handwritten may be simpler. In your final exam, it will be handwritten because you will not have any computer resources for the final exam. For the lab exercises, I have the 6 lab exercises modified from previous lab exercises from Calgary. We'll put all the data files in one place, and after I go through these six, we will try to put them today or tomorrow latest. And you can take a look, and if you have any questions, we can discuss them towards the end of the lectures tomorrow. We were hoping to do that earlier so you could take a look at the problems and questions and lab assignments and discuss with me, but it's hard to do all of that in 3 days. So you'll be writing a program to implement the Pan-Tompkins algorithm using MATLAB. The Pan-Tompkins algorithm is an important algorithm that has several significant features. It's been evaluated in several studies and found to perform well. The basic elements are similar to what I have mentioned so far. You need a derivative. It's based on the first derivative. But the derivative could be noisy, so you need to smooth it. The derivative has positive and negative values, so you must square it. So the basic steps are simply derivative, squaring, loop aspirating, heat detection. That's the general idea of almost all QRS detection algorithms that were proposed in the 70s and 80s. And later on, other pattern matching methods and wavelets and so on have been proposed, but this is an adequate representation of the problem and potential solutions. So here the problem considered is an algorithm to detect QRS complexes in an ongoing ECG signal in real-time online. That is what Pan and Tompkins were interested in. So they proposed a real-time QRS detection algorithm based on the analysis of the slope, the amplitude, and width of QRS complexes. The algorithm includes a series of filters and methods that are expressed in terms of low pass, high pass, derivative, squaring, and iteration. And after that, thresholding and search procedures, scanning for peaks. And we'll go through those. We should be able to finish before the lunch break. So first, you need a bandpass filter. You have to remove low-frequency artifact, you have to remove high-frequency artifact, you have to remove power line interference. That's what we saw a few minutes ago. So clean the ECG first, then apply a differentiator, just derivative, XN minus 1. Because you'll be doing more filtering later, so you can separate the task of filtering and derivatives. Then there is squaring. Note that squaring is nonlinear, so there is no transfer function, or you cannot do frequency domain analysis there. But that is simply to convert the negative values to positive, so you get a positive pulse. You could take the absolute value, but even that is nonlinear. You can put a rectifier, that's also nonlinear. You can square it, which is also ancillary. So the squaring may be substituted by a rectifier or taking the absolute value. Moving window integrator is next used to smooth the squared result into a pulse, so that it has to convert the QRS into a rectangular pulse. But it will quite likely not be a rectangle, it will be a smooth pulse. Now, if we go back to squaring, I said you could use the absolute value, but squaring has the advantage of boosting large values and relatively suppressing small values. So the P and T waves are suppressed in the result and QRS is boosted. So the nonlinearity of squaring has advantage.